Get away. All right. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call the meeting of the House Committee on Rules to order for Tuesday, March 7th, 2017. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a open a public hearing on 2428 and 2430.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2428 allows candidate one business day to pay fee for candidate space and voter's pamphlet if Secretary of State or County Clerk determines that signature petition did not contain required number of signatures of active voters, prohibits Secretary of State from requiring candidate to file signature petition for space and voter's pamphlet prior to date when candidate is required to pay fee. And then, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2430 requires all information provided as part of candidate's statement for voter's pamphlet to be true, punishes violation by a maximum of 5 years imprisonment, $125,000 fine, or both.
Okay. Are you ready? All right. Well, Rep. Williamson, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, bringing you both of these bills. I think we'll start with the 2428 bill around voter's pamphlets. The current practice for a voter's pamphlet is that if you are a candidate who's filed for office and you are looking to not pay cash for your voter's pamphlet and use your sort of grassroots networks, that you can gather signatures. We changed it. It used to be 300 signatures. We changed it to 200 if you're in a legislative district. It's 500 if you're running as a statewide candidate. They have to be valid signatures. And so when we turn those signatures into the Secretary of State's office, they do go through and actually look to see if the elector who has signed the signature gathering sheet is qualified, and by qualified meaning that they are actually active voters here in our state. If a person is inactive and you don't have the number of signatures on the threshold and the window has come and gone for you to pay cash, then you don't get a voter's pamphlet statement if you turn those signatures in. So this bill does two things. One, it says that if you use the signature gathering process and you didn't meet the qualification of having enough signatures, that we would give you a sort of a make good opportunity to then pay the filing fee so that you are not discriminating against having a voter's pamphlet. The other challenge is that if you are gathering signatures and choose that option, the current practice has been in the Secretary of State's office is to ask you as a candidate to get a template that can take a couple days, especially depending on how busy they are. That can take a couple days to get the template, get the signatures, and then they ask that you are trying to gather those signatures and turn them in and give the Secretary of State's office essentially 10 business days to actually do that counting piece. So if on the 2016 election cycle, if you look, I did not put this as part of the file, and I can get a copy of it for anybody who wants the calendar, but if you recall, we all filed for office on March 8th, which is a Tuesday. We always file on a Tuesday. The withdrawal deadline is always on a Friday, 3 days later. But our voters' pamphlets were due on Thursday, March 10th of 2016, this last year. So if you are a candidate who files on the very last day, the signature gathering process is not available to you. The timeline of the calendar does not work. And so there's a parity problem with being able to gather signatures for a voter's pamphlet versus paying cash. We know that our voter's pamphlet statements are $750 to be a legislator. It's $3,000 if you're a minor or if you're running for a statewide office. If you're a minor party candidate, the odds that you are going to be able to come up with $3,000 if you file on filing deadline day, pretty slim to none. And the current practices, and there's another bill for this, but we don't actually even let folks have an online voter's pamphlet statement. So you're just out. You don't have anywhere to publicly, officially put why you're running for office and share that with voters. And so this bill attempts to also get at the issue of the timing of that so that there is parity with a cash payment on the signature gathering piece. And I will turn it over to Steve Elzinga to sort of talk about a potential fix to the bill that makes this work with the Secretary of State's office so that there would be no fiscal to implement this.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Steve Elzinga. I'm the Governmental and Legal Affairs Director for the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State is supportive of House Bill 2428 with some clarifying amendments that make it work logistically. We support the policy of making the elections process more friendly to grassroots powered campaigns, making it easier for minor parties and minor party candidates to participate in the election process. In order to have the time for our agency to fully process all the signatures that would be required. We would need to move the deadline 10 days up because in 2016 we spent 334 hours verifying the signatures related to this issue. And so in order to avoid having to hire a group of temporary workers that would have to come in and process them all in one day, if we don't move the deadlines, we have to move the deadline 10 days up, which would give us a chance to fully process and create equity for people who pay the fee and for people who choose to do the grassroots oriented way of collecting signatures.
And Chair Williamson, members of the committee, it's part of that moving that time filing up in order to make this and to create that parity is if when you get a chance to look at an elections calendar and they publish this once a year and the dates are very prescribed, that if we filed our voters' pamphlets in the May primary on March 10th, within a few days after that, March 16th, those materials were then available for public inspections. That's when they would go public. So they do need that time window to be able to gather and actually verify that the signatures are indeed valid to meet the other timelines that then fall in order to get voters' pamphlets published and out the door and to voters and to our military veterans and people overseas who are voting. And so that's the need to move that timeline back a little bit in order to accommodate what is otherwise creating a parity issue around being able to have access to the voters' pamphlet.
And we really appreciate Representative Parrish being willing to work with us on the logistical details, and we're willing to work with any legislator who's got, you know, election, make sure it's administratable, and that's important for the smooth functioning of our election system.
Great, thank you. Questions? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I may have missed this, but how long does it take to count and verify? Is that weeks? Is that days? Does it depend?
2016, we spent 334 hours for all the petitions. So it's just a matter of how many, it's a staff workload issue. So if you have, you know, processing for the voters pamphlet and the number of things that are demands on our time, currently we spread that out over the 10 days before the deadline so that we don't have to have a ton of staff doing it. But if you compact the deadlines, the current language of the bill would compact the deadlines to require us to bring in extra staff on one day so we could process all of them to meet with the deadlines. So we just need to, if we move the deadlines a few days forward, earlier in the calendar, then that would allow us to process it with existing staff resources and thus avoiding the fiscal impact.
Representative Hack, the current process has been, while it's not written in statute or anywhere, but that they tell candidates, Secretary of State's office has historically told candidates, you really need to have these signatures in within 10 days so that we can make sure that they are counted and verified by the filing deadline. So it's not that we're asking, you know, it's not, historically, it's not been the practice that you turn in your signatures just like when someone's paying cash. You're actually having to say to folks, well, it's, the filing deadline to run for office is on, you know, the March 8th, but if you are going to gather signatures, you really had to know that about a month prior. And so you're excluding all those people who come sort of late filers or, you know, the process for a lot of our minor parties, since they don't have access to a taxpayer-funded primary, is they're doing that in the summertime when they should be out gathering signatures. They haven't even necessarily sometimes assigned their candidate up until that filing deadline. And so that's who's really being excluded, is particularly our minor party candidates. So in moving that deadline, I think you also deal with some issues. There's a bill that'll be up on Thursday around sort of that incumbent protection piece, and the same calendar creates that same problem when you have 3 days and you're running into weekends and opening up PACs and all the things that you have to do with the campaigns. This calendar really should guide some of those decisions on what those dates look like, because otherwise you can't actually respond to some of these dates are actually in statute. So to move that back, I think, creates that parity piece, at least for this bill that we're talking about.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions? Senator McClain.
Steve, under the current law, if I use signatures to get the fee waived or to facilitate support for my grassroots, you know, candidacy or whatever my motivation, but I miss it by one and I'm after the deadline of submitting a voter's pamphlet for fee, then I'm out, right?
Yes, okay. That's the current process.
And so that's why we're supportive of the grace period.
Okay. And so this particular bill, and I'm not sure which number it is, and Representative Parrish, you probably would then basically say that if you missed your target, then you got 24 hours to pay the fee and still get in.
Because you've already submitted the voter's pamphlet, Representative McClain. You've already submitted the voter's pamphlet. You've already submitted the SELs. You've submitted everything that goes with this, except for the fact that when you, the Secretary of State's office, if they've responded to you with counting the signatures after that filing deadline, because they're sometimes running, they tell people 10 days, but I watched candidates who ran all the way up to the very end and they were great about trying to get that done, but had that determination come after, then you wouldn't have the opportunity to do the make good piece of, let me give you the money for the fee or, you know, and try to at least still have a voter's pamphlet. You would be out. You would have no voter's pamphlet under the current law.
So if I may follow up, so I'll just make the statement. I think that this is a good thing because I, for one, in 1 year, well, in fact, I haven't gathered signatures because the year I started to, it was a disincentive to think that I could not get over the total because you might have some folks sign up that maybe don't check out as far as signatures match or whatever, and then you'd miss a voter's pamphlet. And the only one who can win an election and miss a voter's pamphlet in a contested race is Bill Hansel. So for me, I got to have the voter's pamphlet. So I do think this actually creates an incentive to go for it, which is a good thing.
The other piece, I'll just say, Chair Williamson, members of the committee, is the folks, there are organizations out there who endorse all of us. And sometimes when you're out trying to gather these signatures, the process to have a voter's pamphlet by signatures, you have to have decided what you want to say. You have to know who's already endorsed you. They have already had to have had their process. So any change to your voter's pamphlet, so let's say you have a great endorsement that comes in after you've started this process and you want to use it, you're out of luck. You can't change it, or you have to start your signature gathering process all over. You have to go back to the Secretary of State's office and get a template. So by creating that parity, we are also allowing people to participate in those endorsement process and still gather signatures, because right now that is they're excluded. And a lot of folks, unfortunately, through their process, go right up to the very last minute thinking that we're just going to pay the $750 or the $3,000. You know, we saw this with the candidate who was the Pacific Green Party candidate for governor in 2014, who filed basically on the very last minute. There was no money at the Pacific Green Party, right, a $3,000 check, and he had no voter's pamphlet. And the Secretary of State's office wouldn't even give him an online voter's pamphlet, like Sue said, is a different bill. But there was not even a process to have a place where publicly there is a real record that holds that candidate accountable, and I think that just does a disservice to voters.
Then Bretto.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So is the 10 days not a guaranteed time frame then? I mean, you say about 10 days, but it may take longer?
My understanding is that if you submit the signatures within the 10 days, before the 10 days, then you're guaranteed.
Then you're guaranteed.
If you don't, then we will do our best to get it done, but we cannot guarantee.
Yeah. Representative Nose.
So, Madam Chair, thank you. I got on the ballot with signatures and unfortunately, and submitted early. I knew enough to do that. And because I submitted early, I found out I did not collect enough signatures and had to go back out and try to get more. And that was a bummer. But at least I had the opportunity to go back and do it, so I'm very supportive of this idea.
Okay, thank you. Representative Smith Warner.
In the hopes of full participation by the committee, I thought I would come up with a question. No, just kidding. So I love this concept as well. It makes a lot of sense. I mostly think about signature gathering as something you generally do in the general, because just because then you don't have quite the March deadline and we're in this building if you're an incumbent. I guess I'm just trying to figure out the second part about the date moving, because if I came and decided that I wanted to run for something the day before the filing deadline, are you saying this pushes it back so you would still have 10 more days to collect signatures if you were on the late end too? Because what I get and am fully supportive of, if you collect your signatures, you get them in, and they say, oh no, not quite enough, you have one day to pay the $750 or whatever and get it in. But what was the, I still am a little unclear when you were talking about the dates on the second part, so I wondered if you could clarify that.
Or you want me to clarify that? Okay, so The Secretary of State's office is asking to move back then the filing deadline. Currently, it's for the primary, for example, 70th day before the primary election. They'd actually move that back to create a big enough space to accept those signatures all the way to the very end. And so let's say you do still file on filing deadline day, and I go over to the Secretary of State's office, and they can generate me a template. Even under this, they would still have the ability to count, you know, get those signatures. That extra 10 days then gives them time to count those signatures after that filing deadline. And then if they come back to me and say, Julie, you didn't get enough, you know, signatures, then I can opt to write them a check and do that. So they need some extra time on their end to not have compacted how many people are going to do the signature counting. Because literally what they do is, if you have a petition, and for legislative seats, it's 200 signatures, and you know, we always tell folks, get like 300 so that you have enough, then literally they have to just open up the voter file and go line by line by line and look for folks. And if they're inactive, they don't count. And so they just need more time to do that. The problem with just doing it without moving the registration date back and giving them extra time in the calendar is there are other things in the calendar that are impacted by time. So when they have to make that public notice for, you know, military, and when they have to actually get the book to the to the printer so that they can get it in people's mailboxes, all of that has very prescribed dates associated with it. So by moving that window, when we file for office back, it will allow us to create an opportunity for the Secretary of State's office to have enough time to then count those signatures so I can actually turn my signatures in on filing deadline day.
Okay, so my follow-up is, but there's two deadlines we were talking about here that happen. There is the filing deadline, and there is the turning in your voter pamphlet deadline. So would your thing just change the filing deadline, or would it change the voter pamphlet deadline due date
as well? Just the filing
deadline. Now, instead of there being 3 days between them, there are 10 days.
There would be...
Because right now there's three, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes, there's two. It's two.
So I thought it was Tuesday to Friday.
The 68th day. The Friday is the withdrawal deadline if you didn't
want
to be in the ballot.
So now instead of 2 days, it'll be 9 days. You will have nine more days after the filing deadline to turn in, to do your voter pamphlet, to submit your voter pamphlet in one way or another.
I don't think this...
See, this is what I'm trying to get through, is there's two different... The date that you have to file as a candidate and the date that your voter pamphlet is due are two different days.
So, no, it does not change the date we would collect the voter's pamphlet. It would say that on the date that the voter's pamphlet is due, when you would normally pay cash because you didn't have time to do the signatures, that because we moved the filing deadline back, it'd still be that 2 days. It would just give them more time to count the signatures and not put pressure on the rest of the calendar. That's how I understand it.
And just if I could follow up on that, the moving the deadline, Representative Warner, is not in the current bill. This would be an adjustment that we'd need to do an amendment on to get this fixed. As the bill is currently written, there would be a fiscal impact in our office to do it in the compacted timeline. And so there isn't actually language before you with
the deadline.
This would be an amendment that we need to work on.
And I just want to be clear, though, but the deadline that you want to move is the filing for office deadline, not the filing your voter pamphlet statement deadline.
Correct. No, incorrect?
This is, yeah.
Can I bring Steve down? Elections director?
Nope. You got to figure this out yourself.
Calendar and a whiteboard.
It is a very complicated.
It is. It's inordinately complicated for what you're trying to do.
Elections calendar, crazy.
Let's use actual dates.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director. Grateful to come up and hopefully clarify. This is why we need to sit down and work on an amendment, because to make sure that we get these timelines right. You know, my understanding, as we've talked about it, as far as how we would administer this, would be that both the filing deadline for candidates and for the voters pamphlet would be the same day. And then we would have this 10-day window to verify those signatures.
That's right.
Okay, that's, if I may, that's different. That's different than the way I was thinking about this. I don't know about my colleagues, but that...
And I didn't think that we were moving the voter pamphlet filing deadline day. So we might have to bit of work to get the amendment
but
right.
But either way, we have to amend this bill.
Yes, yes. Right? Absolutely. Yes.
Sounds like
yes,
it.
Absolutely.
And we will move, we need to amend this bill.
But we will get it, Representative Smith-Warner, we will get it all cleaned up so that is clear when it comes back with an amendment. You know, and literally they're doing this so that they don't create a fiscal and we will get the calendar dates right.
And my last follow-up, I would just argue that that I think is one of the things that we kind of, because indeed, where do you need that time? Where, you know, is that you need more time between that filing day and the day the voter pamphlet statement is due? Or, you know, what, where exactly is it that you need the time so that you can continue to have the capacity?
Sounds like Representative Smith Warner would like to work on this issue.
There we go.
Just sounds like
there's
it.
A work group or a task force somewhere that'll.
Representative Rayfield.
I just have a real simple question. How many times in the last election cycle and the cycle before did we have anybody that missed this? So what's the actual problem? So do we have like 10 candidates that this screwed up? Do we have zero people that this messed up and we're just doing moving dates and it's not going to impact anyone?
So Representative Rayfield, Chair Williamson, I can't speak to anybody who was missed in the last election cycle. I think what's happening is people are not participating. And so the problem we're trying to fix is to give people who are either minor parties that don't have PAC dollars, or maybe there are people in major parties who are not chosen candidates, but to give people the ability to actually meet the deadlines of filing for office and having enough window after that filing for office so that they can get their signatures in, have them actually be counted, participate in the process. If you go look at how many people are on the ballot versus folks in the voter's pamphlet, there's a huge discrepancy, I believe.
And Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, I don't know the exact number. I know that it has happened, and I think we're going to talk about that in a bill a little bit later. The scope of that, we could go back and find those numbers for you, but I just don't have that off the top of my head.
And then the last question, when we change the filing deadline and move it back, I know a lot of, and off the top of my head, I know some dates trigger other events, right? And these things are very interrelated. When we change the filing deadline date, what other deadlines and other, how does this affect the entire calendar?
Madam Chair, Representative Rayfield, that's exactly what we need to sit down with Legislative Council and make sure that we cover all of those things, because then what happens if someone withdraws and
yeah.
How is that impacted by the calendar? And so we've been trying to have that discussion this morning, and we've addressed some of those issues, but that's something that we need a little bit of time to work out and make sure that we do this right so that there's not unintended consequences and that the intentions of the sponsor are what we are able actually to achieve.
And then I think having a sample calendar when you guys come back so we could actually visually see it instead of talking about dates out here, I think it'd be easier to visually look at them on a calendar.
Okay, I'd like to have one more question.
Sure, Representative Smith Warner.
I would like to preemptively excuse myself from the work group. No, I'm just kidding. So the other thing I think that we need to think about in the calendar is right now, the filing deadline, you know, it's a big day, everybody comes, you guys put stuff up on the board, and the short session is over when that happens. And so we need to think about if we moved it back a week or a couple days, short session might still be, we might still be within the constitutional timeline of the short session and how that would play out. Just something to think about.
Oh, you're doing the work group. The fact that you thought of that means you need to do the work group. All right, any other questions? All right, thank you all. We are still in a public hearing on House Bill 2430.
Great, so this one, real simple, it's only a few lines. Currently, when you fill out your, for the record again, Julie Parrish, House District 37, here on House Bill 2430, when you fill out your voter's pamphlet statement, the only language that we are upheld to for being truthful is the first four lines. So those bolded, what are our occupation, what's our education, and the fine schedule that you see in this bill is the current fine schedule for if you lie on those first four bolded statements. The rest of your 325 words, I could write in my voter's pamphlet statement that I cure cancer, and when I'm not in the legislature, I am vacationing in my condo on the moon, and it would not matter. That nobody could hold me accountable for what's in my voter's pamphlet statement. I feel like with all of the mail and marketing and media and telephone calls and everything else that goes out in a campaign, voters have an expectation that what is said in our voter's pamphlet statement is true. I have witnessed times when I have seen less than truthful information go out in voter pamphlet statements at different levels of government, and I think it's important that there's one document out there that voters can have an expectation that what we say about ourselves
is actually true. And so this would bring the entire voter's pamphlet statement into that same parity as the first four bolded subject lines and hold us accountable as candidates for what we say and how we campaign to voters in what is a formal government document.
So I actually have a question. The first four statements are all verifiable facts. What do you do with opinion?
Well, I mean, so we do have, if I wanted to file a complaint right now, the current law is I can take it to court. So this would follow, I believe, those statutes where you have the ability to file a complaint through the court system if somebody is not currently following those rules.
But how do you define truthfulness if it's an opinion?
Well, I think you can bring your facts to any court or our ethics bodies and say, hey, this is, you know, what I know to be the truth, and let somebody be the arbiter of that. But right now, I don't have any obligation to even remotely try to be truthful because we don't require that.
Okay, and my second question is, it does create an additional C felony, and I know at least through the Judiciary Committee process, anything that creates a crime, we send to Ways and Means. And so we should probably, I can't imagine that we're gonna have a rush on C felonies of people lying on their voter's pamphlet statement, but I would be interested just to have a once over, because it does create a crime, so.
Does this apply to all offices? So, like, if you were running for, like, federal offices and state offices.
Congressman Cooley? Or who?
I was thinking President Trump.
President Trump?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Would it apply, like, all the way up and down
the current scale? The current statute for voters' pamphlets in Oregon for those first four bolded subjects applies to all of us, whether you're running for dog catcher or president of the United States.
And follow-up? And then it applies all the way down to the bottom on the county level or the city level as well. I just want to make sure because they're administered, one's by the county, one's by the state, right?
But the actual law, Representative Rayfield, the actual current law applies to all voters' pamphlet statements. So this bring that in parity.
Questions? All right.
A lot to think about.
Okay, we do have one more person that wants to testify on this, but we're going to close this hearing. Sorry,
that's fine.
Kimberly,
I'm
going
to get back to the committee.
And then we're going to open, we'll be back to that, Kimberly, in a sec. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2349. Steve Trout, if you want to come on down, or Steve, any of the Steves.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2349 prohibits circulating or printing of imitation voters' pamphlet unless pamphlet is clearly marked as unofficial, establishes a fine of up to $10,000 for violations of this requirement.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Steve Elzinga, Governmental and Legal Affairs Director for the Secretary of State. We're here today in support of House Bill 2349. House Bill 2349 prohibits the printing or circulation of an imitation voter's pamphlet unless the pamphlet is clearly identified on the material that it is an unofficial pamphlet. In previous election cycles, there have been instances in which a candidate running for state office or individuals in support or opposition to a ballot measure produced and distributed material that appeared to closely resemble the state voter's pamphlet. Our office has received many calls from citizens who are confused and upset, and in order to eliminate voter confusion on these types of material, it is imperative that the material is clearly identified as an unofficial document. I submitted into the records an article from the Oregonian from the last election cycle where there's a situation in Speaker Kotek's primary where her opponent produced an imitation voter's pamphlet that was clearly intended to deceive, and the Secretary of State's office needs additional enforcement tools to stop that kind of conduct in the future. And so the way House Bill 2349 is currently worded is that it would ensure that unofficial documents are clearly labeled so that voters will not be confused or misled by requiring that the document be labeled, "This is not the official voter's pamphlet," in all caps. It also must be printed in bold in at least 36-point type, and the word unofficial must be superimposed on each page of the imitation voter's pamphlet. We've heard from several groups, the League of Women Voters, the Independent Party of Oregon, concerns over whether this would impact their ability to distribute, you know, voters' pamphlet, voters' guide type of information. Clearly, they have no intent to deceive the populace. And so we're open to any sort of amendments this committee thinks would be helpful in clarifying the intent of the bill, because the intent is going after people who are clearly trying to fraudulently mislead people as to that the document is coming from the state, such as the example in the Speaker Kotex primary in the past. The intent is not to go after people who are just distributing important information to the voters of Oregon. And so specifically the word imitation probably could use a little bit of definition that would narrow the scope of the bill just to ease any concerns that people might have.
Thank you, Mr. Trout.
Madam Chair, I don't have anything to add. Mr. Elzing has covered it well. It's here for questions.
Questions. And I will say, for anybody who saw that voter pamphlet statement in that primary, it was clearly intended to deceive. It was, I learned Speaker Kotex High School out of that false voters pamphlet, so that was very exciting. Anything else? All right, great. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2349, and I'll reopen House Bill 2430 and invite up Kimberly McCullough.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I am here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I just want to raise some constitutional issues with you here. We have deep concerns that House Bill 2430 would be unconstitutional under the First Amendment. There are a number of very similar laws which have been struck down by various courts around the country. I'm just going to go through a couple of cases for you. Excuse me for being a little legal nerdy here, but the one that you may all actually know about is U.S. versus Alvarez. It had to do with the Stolen Valor Act. That was a law that was passed by Congress to criminalize someone pretending like they were a veteran or a decorated military veteran. There was a man who went to a public meeting of a public water district board and stated that he had a Congressional Medal of Honor. He didn't, and he was then convicted under the statute and challenged it under the First Amendment. And basically what the court said there is that so there's protected free speech, and then there are categories of speech which are not protected. And some of those categories actually have to do with false statements. The one that you all probably would think about most commonly is defamation. And defamation is actually fairly, it has to be fairly narrow, depending on the circumstances. And it has to be really narrow when it has to do with attacking a public figure, basically like political speech. So basically what they do with things that don't fit into those traditional categories, which this doesn't fit into that category or any of those categories, is they apply strict scrutiny. So they say there needs to be a compelling state interest, and the statute has to be narrowly tailored to meet that compelling state interest. So in that particular case, they basically said, you know, there may be some interest, but it wasn't compelling enough and it wasn't narrowly tailored. So there's another case then that happened in the Sixth Circuit just last year, actually, Susan B. Anthony versus Ohio Elections, and it took that framework and applied it to something very similar. They had a political false statement law that had to do with statements about candidates in campaign materials. And the court there cited the Alvarez case, and they pointed out that political speech is subject to even higher scrutiny than other types of speech because it's so important that people feel free to just be able to speak without being scared they're going to get criminalized for it, right? And so they said, yeah, there is a compelling state interest here in protecting the integrity of elections and informing the voters, but the problem is that the law is not narrowly tailored because there's another solution to this problem of false speech in political materials. The other solution is more speech, right? People can point it out. And it's the same thing with the Stolen Valor Act. This guy said that he had a Congressional Medal of Honor. Other people said, no, he didn't. And he got in trouble for it, like in the public eye, right? And he got shamed, he lost his job, all sorts of things happened. So when people make false political statements and somebody else says, hey, that's a false political statement, they provide some counter speech, then it plays out in the court of public opinion. So the problem is that when we have politicians really scared to speak, especially when it comes to gray areas like what is opinion, what is actually a true statement or not, is there some spin on this, are we just putting our own kind of our own angle on it, it becomes really, really dangerous when we start to potentially criminalize politicians who are speaking all the time. So basically, in that case, they struck down the law. There are a number of other cases that have applied that same analysis in different various state courts and state Supreme Courts. And I have not submitted my testimony yet, but I will submit that as soon as I finish here, and you guys can look at the analysis more.
Kimberly, do we have anything under Article 1, Section 8?
I bet we would, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so Article 1, Section 8, just so everybody's on the same page, is the Oregon's free speech clause. So under the Oregon Constitution, basically the way constitutional law works is the federal constitution provides us with a certain amount of protection. It's like the floor. And then the state constitution can never take that away, but it can add on top. And Oregon's Article 1, Section 8 is much more restrictive than the First Amendment. And what that means is that we have more free speech rights here than we do, than other folks in the rest of the country. And so it is extremely likely that if it's unconstitutional under the First Amendment, it's probably subject to stricter scrutiny under Article 1, Section 8.
Yeah. So the law's already in place with the first part of the voter's pamphlet statement, and that would be deemed speech, right? And so the question would be, has that ever been challenged, whether that's unconstitutional there? And because really it's just an extension of existing law. And maybe it hasn't been challenged, but it is unconstitutional. The other question, I'm just kind of curious there. And then
So this is something I don't actually know, so I'm a little outside of my expertise area, is what those specific things are that are required to be true. Because if it's just things like you have to truly state your name, you have to truly state your party affiliation, the office you're running for, what your work history is, I would say that that's like much more tailored than the statement itself, which is expressing your values and what you think about things.
The only other follow-up to that it'd be interesting to know that history, right? Because there are some subjective things in there where people have actually been penalized, and there was somebody in Eastern Oregon that I think that actually faced jail time, and I assume that their defense lawyer would have asserted a constitutionality issue with that. It's like judiciary all over for you. It's like two
I
days
love
in
this
one.
Stuff.
And so the other question is, the difference that I was looking at says knowingly. So the other case law that you're citing, does this have the knowingly misleading false statements versus this? And because it's a very specific document rather than just speech in general. So
yeah, that's right. I believe that the Susan B. Anthony case, at least I can remember off the top of my head, was I believe it was a knowingly or recklessly standard.
Yeah.
As far as those previous cases, I would imagine that a good attorney would have raised a First
right.
Amendment challenge. Yeah. I don't know about that case, so I don't know what happened there. But it might be something that we could research, or maybe we could talk to legislative counsel about, or somebody else. Yeah.
Representative McLean.
Thank you. The candidate / congressman who violated that was from Powell Butte, where I live. And Wes Cooley, and his misrepresentation was his service in the U.S. Army during Vietnam. But I think our chair put it well when the first areas of the statement that are prescribed with regards to veracity today are verifiable. And the rest does get into opinion, like, the best candidate. you know, stands for education, and, you know, will support your constitutional rights, things like that, which are sales, and albeit informational. So it is when you go from verifiable information, which either this fact did occur or did not, versus, as you said, values, it does become problematic. And I think I can think of a couple of cases based on Article 1, Section 8 that would be difficult, this law in it. But that being the case, the West Cooley case, I'm not aware of what defense they raised, but the nature of the mischaracterization is such a swift rebuke in the public. Mm-hmm. That the criminal sanction, albeit legitimate and threat, is certainly not the most pronounced in consequence. And anyone who misrepresents, like stolen valor, often receives a rebuke, if not a blanket party, when they exit that forum. So that is a consequence which, of course, is probably more of a deterrent than sanction. But I will say it's probably sobering to every lawyer or licensed professional that when you sign a document that says this could have criminal consequence for representation, and then we also have interpretations that say if you misrepresent, for an example, your residence to get a cheaper admission to the Multnomah Athletic Club, that can cause you to be suspended. And we had a lawyer do that so she could save some money on her monthly charge, and it actually had consequence for her bar license. Then anytime you do where there's criminal sanctions. So I wonder if that would be a chilling effect for folks filling that out. I don't know about other members of the bar, but I certainly have a sobering pause before I sign anything with Absolutely. Criminal consequence.
Absolutely. And I would just add, I think the first for requirements of truthfulness, it's verifiable fact, and it's also telling the voters, you know, who you are objectively. And so I would guess that in a strict scrutiny analysis, that they just weigh it differently, right? That's more important than once you start getting into the opinion piece and the likelihood of chilling political speech. It's such a high bar to limit political speech.
I for one don't want to, you know, I think Representative Parrish's intent is good in that
Absolutely.
She's saying, hey, we don't want people saying crazy stuff, you know, fake news, so to speak, in a voter's pamphlet, and we don't want people misrepresenting themselves. So it may be that her bill can't pass constitutional scrutiny, but I think she has correctly pointed out that we do have a flaw, and if the other side doesn't have the money to compete in speech, meaning advertisement, then someone theoretically could get elected completely fabricating, you know, their endorsements, for an example. I can imagine in a Democratic primary, like we do in a Republican primary, there are, you know, four or five pretty key endorsements. And if you're out there saying you got them and you didn't, you know, you might win the primary, and someone may later say, oh, my God, he lied or she lied. But, you know, so what? You're on the general election ballot. And that's a real consequence. But anyway, I'm glad you're the chair and you get to decide.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think for purposes of the endorsement, I believe we have to fill out a form. Mm-hmm. That says the organization that endorsed has to submit something to the Secretary of State as part of the voter's pamphlet. So that is also somewhat verifiable. You don't just get to put it on there. Somebody has to vouch for it.
I suppose, if I could, I suppose, like anything, there are ways around it.
I want to get around.
We're both creative people. I suppose over lunch we could figure out a few ways, but. Who wants to, right?
The Secretary of State could remove that statement without the form, or at least it would drive a phone call.
Right.
Well, but whether they can or can, I suppose, in the end, the issue is the fabrication, when you actually intentionally fabricate versus embellish. Because we all endure family reunions where, you know, embellishment goes on all the time, right? So, and certainly prohibiting or making it criminal for politicians to embellish would be a horrible, horrible cut down half my stories. But yeah, the criminalization and, of the values, that's a problem.
I would just
Representative McLean, Chair Williamson, I think that the point you make is very good, which is that what we're dealing with here is a criminal sanction. And the higher the sanction, the higher the standard is going to be. And so if this was, say, for example, an ethical violation or a civil penalty, I think we would be potentially looking at something slightly different. I can't speak to the specific constitutionality of it in that circumstance, but I think when you're looking at something that's a criminal penalty, the chilling effect is huge.
I would say this conversation really speaks to the wisdom of our current speaker for not putting us on the Judiciary Committee.
I think that's absolutely wise of her to ban you and I from anything like that.
All right. Any final thoughts? All right. Thank you, Kimberly. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2430, and I'm going to open a public hearing on 2586.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2586 exempts fees associated with filing voter's pamphlet statement from $750 threshold required to file as a political committee.
Madam Chair, I have to testify.
Go testify away.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, not Representative Mike McLean, because he is rudely leaving this presentation.
I have to testify in the committee.
This bill?
I thought it was something I said, Representative. This bill is about increasing, reducing barriers, I should say, for candidates to run for office.
I need to know your name.
Oh, Dan Rayfield, Representative Dan Rayfield. Yep. I'll start again.
Start over.
Yeah, just take one. Back at the top, everyone. This bill is about reducing barriers for candidates to run for office. Probably all of you remember the first time that you filed for office, Representative Kenemer, back in the 70s. One of the things that we had, you had to open up a PAC, and for a lot of folks, that is an intimidating thing to do the first time you do it. A lot of third parties actually aren't going to spend very much money, but they need to have a voter's pamphlet statement to get their voice heard. The way that our laws are written right now, if you file a voter's pamphlet statement, you automatically have to file with ORSTAR. And so what this bill essentially does is exempt the $750 that you spend for a voter's pamphlet statement on your requirement of that threshold for you to file or create an ORSTAR account. And so that's the bill. This was brought to me by, you know, a couple of third party folks in my district. And then from there, I sat on the campaign finance task force. It was brought up then as well by some third party members is there, which is the bill.
Question, Representative Nose.
I do, but it's not well formed, so I'm going to pass.
I can see you formulating it in your brain.
Representative, I would love to free flow on this.
We could do it later.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Rayfield. With that, I am going to close the public hearing. Oh, geez, wrong piece of wood. On House Bill 2586. And I am going to open a work session on SCR 14.
Chair Williamson, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on SCR 14.
Vice Chair Rayfield moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsideration of the vote on SCR 14. Is there any objection? Rules are suspended.
Chair Williamson, I move that we reconsider the vote by which SCR 14 was sent to the floor with it be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Rayfield moves to reconsider the vote by which SCR 14 was sent to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, we will have a voice vote of the committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Ayes have it. Motion passes. SCR 14 is once again before this committee.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have before you a dash one amendment. The amendment speaks to, on page 3, removal of the word commemorate and insert and replace injustice, pain, and suffering inflicted on the Japanese American people by the Executive Order 906.
At the behest of Representative Holvey, Chair Williamson, I would love to move the dash one amendments to SCR 14 with it be adopted.
Vice Chair Rayfield moves the dash one amendments to SCR 14 be adopted. Is there any discussion? Representative Holvey.
Okay, I'll have some discussion about that. Just to inform you that I did suggest the dash one amendment to SCR 14 after listening to the testimony and reading the bill. I became concerned that the original line on page 3, line 7, seemed to acknowledge the 75th anniversary of the signing of the executive order, which seemed sort of like a celebratory type of statement and really wasn't acknowledging the purpose of this concurrent resolution, which really was acknowledging the injustice, pain, suffering that the executive order caused. And so I just made that comment, as you may remember, in committee, and then subsequent to that, the sponsors of the bill, I guess, agreed with me that they thought that would be a good change. And so I acted very quickly with the help of the committee analyst to not slow this bill down very much so that it could still achieve its end goals of timing. And that's why you see this before you today. And I noticed the proponent of the bill is no longer with us, but
she's just not here. Just not in the room.
She's with us, but not with us in this room. And
but you've worked with the sponsors and the proponents of the bill, and this is a very friendly amendment.
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. Any further discussion? Any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 14 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Chair Rayfield moves SCR 14 as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? If not, motion passes. Carries. Representative Clem. With that, I will close the work session on SCR 14. Any other business for the committee? Right, with that, we're adjourned. Other business for the committee.